American help. Although reluctant to interfere, in July 1958, Eisenhower sent 15,000 United States Marines into Lebanon. Order was soon restored, and the Marines were withdrawn. This is standard textbook rhetoric. Chaos seems always to be breaking out, or about to break out. Other than communism, chaos is what textbooks usually offer to explain the actions of the other side. Communism offers no real explanation either. Quitney points out that the United States has often behaved so badly in the Third World that some governments and independence movements saw no alternative but to turn to the USSR. Since textbook authors are unwilling to criticize the U.S. government, they present opponents of the United States that are not intelligible. Only by disclosing our actions can textbooks provide readers with rational accounts of our adversaries. Promise goes on to tell the happy results of our intervention. Although there was no immediate communist threat to Lebanon, Eisenhower demonstrated that the United States could react quickly. As a result, tensions in the region receded. In reality, the civil war in Lebanon broke out again in 1975, with mounting destruction in Beirut and throughout the nation. In 1983, a whole lot of chaos broke out, so President Reagan sent in our Marines again. A truck bomb then killed more than 200 Marines in their barracks, and three textbooks treat that intervention. Two of them say nothing about our involvement in either 1957 or 1958, and the remaining textbook, The American Pageant, tells of Eisenhower's 1958 intervention in even rosier terms than Land of Promise. So not one of 12 textbooks offers students anything of substance about the continuity of conflict in Lebanon or our role in causing it. Zaire, or the Congo, appear in the index of just two textbooks, The American Pageant and Triumph of the American Nation. Neither book mentions that the CIA urged the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in 1961. Pageant offers an accurate account of the beginning of the strife. The African Congo received its independence from Belgium in 1960 and immediately exploded into violence. The United Nations sent in a peacekeeping force, to which Washington contributed much money but no manpower. There, Pageant stops. The account in Triumph of the American Nation mentions Lumumba by name. A new crisis developed in 1961 when Patrice Lumumba, leader of the pro-communist faction, was assassinated. Triumph says nothing about U.S. involvement with the assassination, however, and concludes with the happiest of endings. By the late 1960s, most scars of the Civil War seemed healed. The Congo, Zaire, became one of the most prosperous African nations. Would that it were. The CIA helped to bring power to Joseph Mobutu, a former army sergeant. By the end of the 1960s, Triumph to the contrary, Zaire, under Mobutu, had become one of the most wretched African nations, economically and politically. As of 1993, Mobutu had yet to hold an election, allow the free functioning of political parties, or condone a free press. The New York Times noted that starvation was growing in Zaire and called the problems self-inflicted, the result of nearly 30 years of government corruption. While per capita income in Zaire fell by more than two-thirds, Mobutu himself became one of the richest persons on the planet, and perhaps the most hated person in the country. As I write in 1994, Zaire is ripe for a new crisis to develop, quite possibly with anti-American overtones. If it does, we can be sure textbooks will be just as surprised as our students when chaos breaks out. All 12 textbooks are silent about our repeated attempts to assassinate Premier Fidel Castro of Cuba. The federal government had tried to kill Castro 8 times by 1965, according to testimony before the U.S. Senate. By 1975, Castro had thwarted 24 attempts, according to Cuba. These undertakings ranged from a botched effort to get Castro to light an exploding cigar to a contract with the mafia to murder him. Since President John F. Kennedy probably ordered several of the earlier attempts on Castro's life personally, including the mafia contract, Kennedy's own assassination might be explained as a revenge slaying. Because no textbook tells how Kennedy tried to kill Castro, however, none can logically suggest a Cuban or mafia connection in discussing Kennedy's death. The Kennedy administration also lied about its sponsorship of the Bay of Pigs invasion. Immediately after that failed, Kennedy launched Operation Mongoose, a vast covert program to destabilize Cuba. Pierre Salinger, Kennedy's press secretary, has written that JFK even planned to invade Cuba with U.S. armed forces until forestalled by the Cuban Missile Crisis. No textbook tells about Operation Mongoose. Undaunted by its failures in Cuba, the CIA turned its attention farther south. Only three textbooks, Life and Liberty, The American Adventure, and Triumph of the American Nation, mention Chile. President Nixon helped the Chilean army overthrow Chile's elected government because he did not like its radical socialist policies. Life and Liberty says bluntly, "This single sentence, which is all that Life and Liberty offers, lies buried in a section about President Carter's human rights record, but is far and away the best account in any of the textbooks." According to Triumph, Nixon approved the secret use of funds by the CIA to prevent a socialist-communist election victory in Chile. The CIA later made it difficult for the Marxist government elected by these parties to govern. Since the difficulties President Allende faced included his own murder, perhaps this is the ultimate euphemism. The American Adventure offers a fuller account. Some people, in the United States and abroad, said that the United States arranged the overthrow of Allende. Indeed, in 1974, President Ford admitted that the United States CIA had given help to the opposition to Allende. However, he denied that the United States encouraged or knew of the revolutionary plan. Why leave our involvement open to question? Historians know that the CIA had earlier joined with ITT to try to defeat Allende in the 1970 elections. Failing this, the United States sought to disrupt the Chilean economy and bring down Allende's government. The United States blocked international loans to Chile, subsidized opposition newspapers, labor unions, and political parties, denied spare parts to industries, paid for and fomented a nationwide truckers' strike that paralyzed the Chilean economy, and trained and financed the military that staged the bloody coup in 1973, in which Allende was killed. The next year, CIA Director William Colby testified that a secret high-level intelligence committee led by Kissinger himself had authorized CIA expenditures of over $8 million during the period 1970 to 1973 to destabilize the government of President Allende. Secretary of State Kissinger himself later explained, "I don't see why we have to let a country go Marxist just because its people are irresponsible." Since the Chilean people's irresponsibility consisted of voting for Allende, here Kissinger openly says that the United States should not and will not respect the electoral process or sovereignty of another country if the results don't please us. With this attitude and policy in place in our government, whether the CIA or its Chilean allies pulled the trigger on Allende amounts to a nitpicking detail. The American Adventure at least mentions our action in Chile. However, nine books overlook it entirely. Do textbooks need to include all government skullduggery? Certainly not. I am not arguing in favor of what Paul Gagnon calls relentless mentioning. Textbooks do need to analyze at least one of our interventions in depth, however, for they raise important issues. To defend these acts on moral grounds isn't easy. The acts diminish U.S. foreign policy to the level of mafia thuggery, strip the United States of its claim to lawful conduct, and reduce our prestige around the world. To be sure, covert violence may be defensible on realpolitik grounds, as an appropriate way to deal with international problems. It can be argued that the United States should be destabilizing governments in other countries, assassinating leaders unfriendly to us, and fighting undeclared, unpublicized wars. The 6 cloak-and-dagger operations recounted here don't support this view, however. In Cuba, for instance, the CIA's pointless sabotage operations, in Rodri words, only increased Castro's popularity. Even when they succeed, these covert acts provide only a short-term fix, keeping people who worry us out of power for a time, but identifying the United States with repressive, undemocratic, unpopular regimes, hence undermining our long-term interests. The historian Ronald Kessler relates that a CIA officer responsible for engineering Arbenz's downfall in Guatemala agreed later that overthrowing elected leaders is a short-sighted policy. "Was it desirable to trade Mossadegh for the Ayatollah Khomeini?" asks the historian Charles Amringer about our success in Iran. When covert attacks fail, like the Bay of Pigs landing in 1961, they leave the U.S. government with no viable next step short of embarrassed withdrawal or overt military intervention. If instead of covert action, we had a public debate about how to handle Mossadegh or Castro, we might have avoided Khomeini or the Bay of Pigs debacle. Unless we become more open to nationalist governments that embody the dreams of their people, Robert F. Smith believes we will face crisis after crisis. This debate cannot take place in American history courses, however, because most textbooks don't let on about what our government has done. Half of the 12 textbooks I surveyed leave out all 6 incidents. Most of the other textbooks pretend, when treating 1 or 2 incidents they include, that our actions were based on humanitarian motives. Thus, textbook authors portray the United States basically as an idealistic actor, responding generously to other nations' social and economic woes. Robert Leckie has referred to the myth of the most peace-loving nation of the world and noted that it persists in American folklore. It also persists in our history textbooks. These interventions raise another issue. Are they compatible with democracy? Covert violent operations against foreign nations, individuals, and political parties violate the openness on which our own democracy relies. Inevitably, covert international interference leads to domestic lying. U.S. citizens cannot possibly critique government policies if they don't know about them. Thus, covert violent actions usually flout the popular will. These actions also threaten our long-standing separation of powers, which textbooks so justly laud in their chapters on the Constitution. Covert actions are always undertaken by the executive branch, which typically lies to the legislative branch about what it has done and plans to do, thus preventing Congress from playing its constitutionally intended role. The U.S. government lied about most of the 6 examples of foreign intervention just described. On the same day in 1961 that our Cuban exiles were landing at the Bay of Pigs in their hapless attempt to overthrow Fidel Castro, Secretary of State Dean Rusk said, "The American people are entitled to know whether we are intervening in Cuba or intend to do so in the future. The answer to that question is no." Among the dead 3 days later were 4 American pilots. When asked about Chile in his Senate confirmation hearings for U.S. Secretary of State in 1973, Henry Kissinger replied, "The CIA had nothing to do with the Chilean coup, to the best of my knowledge and belief, and I only put in that qualification in case some madman appears down there who, without instruction, talked to somebody." Of course, later statements by CIA Director William Colby and Kissinger himself directly contradicted this testimony. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee eventually denounced our campaign against the Allende government. President Eisenhower used national security as his excuse when he was caught in an obvious lie. He denied that the United States was flying over Soviet airspace, only to have captured airman Gary Powers admit the truth on Russian television. Much later, the public learned that Powers had been just the tip of the iceberg. In the 1950s, we had some 31 flights downed over the USSR, with 170 men aboard. For decades, our government lied to the families of the lost men and never made substantial representation to the USSR to get them back, because the flights were illegal and were supposed to be secret. Similarly, during the Vietnam War, the government kept our bombing of Laos secret for years, later citing national security as its excuse. This didn't fool Laotians, who knew full well we were bombing them, but did fool Americans. Often presidents and their advisors keep actions covert, not for reasons of tactics abroad, but because they suspect the actions would not be popular with Congress or with the American people. Over and over, presidents have chosen not to risk their popularity by waging the campaign required to persuade Americans to support their secret military policies. Our Constitution provides that Congress must declare war. Back in 1918, Woodrow Wilson tried to keep our intervention in Russia hidden from Congress and the American people. Helen Keller helped get out the truth. Our governments are not honest. They don't openly declare war against Russia and proclaim the reasons, she wrote to a New York newspaper in 1919. They are fighting the Russian people half-secretly and in the dark with the lie of democracy on their lips. Ultimately, Wilson failed to keep his invasion secret, but he was able to keep it hidden from American history textbooks. Therein lies the problem. Textbooks cannot report accurately on the six foreign interventions described in this chapter without mentioning that the U.S. government covered them up. The sole piece of criminal government activity that most textbooks treat is the series of related scandals called Watergate. In its impact on the public, the Watergate break-in stood out. In the early 1970s, Congress and the American people learned that President Nixon had helped cover up a string of illegal acts, including robberies of the Democratic National Committee and the office of Lewis Fielding, a psychiatrist. Nixon also tried with some success to use the Internal Revenue Service, the FBI, the CIA, and various regulatory agencies to inspire fear in the hearts of his enemies list of people who had dared to oppose his policies or his reelection. In telling of Watergate, textbooks blame Richard Nixon, as they should. But they go no deeper. Faced with this undeniable instance of governmental wrongdoing, they manage to retain their uniformly rosy view of the government. In the representative words of The United States, A History of the Republic, although the Watergate crisis was a shock to the nation, it demonstrated the strength of the federal system of checks and balances. Congress and the Supreme Court had successfully checked the power of the president when he appeared to be abusing that power. As Richard Rubenstein has pointed out, the problem will not go away with the departure of Richard Nixon, because it is structural, stemming from the vastly increased power of the federal executive bureaucracy. Indeed, in some ways, the Iran-Contra scandal of the Reagan-Bush administrations, a web of secret legal and illegal acts involving the president, vice president, cabinet members, special operatives such as Oliver North, and government officials in Israel, Iran, Brunei, and elsewhere, shows an executive branch more out of control than Nixon's. Textbooks' failure to put Watergate into this perspective is part of their author's apparent program to whitewash the federal government so that schoolchildren will respect it. Since the structural problem in the government has not gone away, it is likely that students will again, in their adult lives, face an out-of-control federal executive pursuing criminal foreign and domestic policies. To the extent that their understanding of the government comes from their American history courses, students will be shocked by these events and unprepared to think about them. Our country, may she always be in the right, toasted Stephen Decatur in 1816, but our country, right or wrong. Educators and textbook authors seem to want to inculcate the next generation into blind allegiance to our country. Going a step beyond Decatur, textbook analyses fail to assess our actions abroad according to either a standard of right or wrong or realpolitik. Instead, textbooks merely assume that the government tried to do the right thing. Citizens who embrace the textbook view would presumably support any intervention, armed or otherwise, and any policy, protective of our legitimate national interests or not, because they would be persuaded that all our policies and interventions are on behalf of humanitarian aims. They could never credit our enemies with equal humanity. This international good guy approach is educationally dysfunctional if we seek citizens who are able to think rationally about American foreign policy. To the citizen raised on textbook platitudes, George Kennan's realpolitik may be painful to contemplate. Under the thrall of the America the Good archetype, we expect more from our country. But Kennan describes how nations actually behave. We wouldn't risk the decline of democracy and the end of Western civilization if we simply let students see a realistic description and analysis of our foreign policies. Doing so would also help close the embarrassing gap between what high school textbooks say about American foreign policy and how their big brothers, college textbooks in political science courses, treat the subject. When high school history textbooks turn to the internal affairs of the U.S. government, the books again part company with political scientists. A large chunk of introductory political science coursework is devoted to analyzing the various forces that influence our government's domestic policies. High school American history textbooks simply credit the government for most of what gets done. This isn't surprising, for when authors idealize the federal government, perforce they also distort the real dynamic between the governed and the government. It's particularly upsetting to watch this happen in the field of civil rights, where the courageous acts of thousands of citizens in the 1960s entreated and even forced the government to act. Between 1960 and 1968, the civil rights movement repeatedly appealed to the federal government for protection and for implementation of federal law, including the 14th Amendment and other laws passed during Reconstruction. Especially during the Kennedy administration, governmental response was woefully inadequate. In Mississippi, movement offices displayed this bitter rejoinder. There's a street in Itabena called Freedom. There's a town in Mississippi called Liberty. There's a department in Washington called Justice. The Federal Bureau of Investigation's response to the movement's call was especially important, since the FBI is the premier national law enforcement agency. The Bureau had a long and unfortunate history of antagonism toward African Americans. J. Edgar Hoover and the agency that became the FBI got their start investigating alleged communists during the Woodrow Wilson administration. Although the last 4 years of that administration saw more anti-black race riots than any other time in our history, Wilson had agents focus on gathering intelligence on African Americans, not on white Americans who were violating black civil rights. Hoover explained the anti-black race riot of 1919 in Washington, D.C., as due to the numerous assaults committed by Negroes upon white women. In that year, the agency institutionalized its surveillance of black organizations, not white organizations like the Ku Klux Klan. In the Bureau's early years, there were a few black agents, but by the 1930s, Hoover had weeded out all but two. By the early 1960s, the FBI had not a single black officer, although Hoover tried to claim it did by counting his chauffeurs. FBI agents in the South were mostly white Southerners who cared what their white Southern neighbors thought of them and were themselves white supremacists. And although this next complaint is reminiscent of the diner who protested that the soup was terrible and there wasn't enough of it, the Bureau had far too few agents in the South. In Mississippi, it had no office at all and relied for its initial reports on local sheriffs and police chiefs, often precisely the people from whom the civil rights movement sought protection. Even in the 1960s, Hoover remained an avowed white supremacist who thought the 1954 Supreme Court decision outlawing racial segregation in Brown v. Board of Education was a terrible error. He helped Kentucky prosecute a Caucasian civil rights leader, Carl Braden, for selling a house in a white neighborhood to a black family. In August 1963, Hoover initiated a campaign to destroy Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. With the approval of Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, he tapped the telephones of King's associates, bugged King's hotel rooms, and made tape recordings of King's conversations with and about women. The FBI then passed on lurid details, including photographs, transcripts, and tapes, to Senator Strom Thurmond and other white supremacists, reporters, labor leaders, foundation administrators, and, of course, the president. In 1964, a high FBI administrator sent a tape recording of King having sex, along with an anonymous note suggesting that King kill himself, to the office of King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. The FBI must have known that the incident might not actually persuade King to commit suicide. The Bureau's intention was apparently to get Coretta Scott King to divorce her husband, or to blackmail King into abandoning the civil rights movement. The FBI tried to sabotage receptions in King's honor when he traveled to Europe to claim the Nobel Peace Prize. Hoover called King the most notorious liar in the country and tried to prove that the SCLC was infested with communists. King wasn't the only target. Hoover also passed on disinformation about the Mississippi Summer Project, other civil rights organizations such as CORE and SNCC, and other civil rights leaders, including Jesse Jackson. At the same time, the FBI refused to pass on to King information about death threats to him. The FBI knew these threats were serious, for civil rights workers were indeed being killed. In Mississippi alone, civil rights workers endured more than 1,000 arrests at the hands of local officials, 35 shooting incidents, and 6 murders. The FBI repeatedly claimed, however, that protecting civil rights workers from violence was not its job. In 1962, SNCC sued Robert F. Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover to force them to protect civil rights demonstrators. Desperate to get the federal government to enforce the law in the Deep South, Mississippi civil rights workers M.Z. Moore and Robert Moses hit upon the 1964 Freedom Summer idea. Bring 1,000 Northern college students, most of them white, to Mississippi to work among blacks for civil rights. Even this helped little. White supremacists bombed 30 homes and burned 37 black churches in the summer of 1964 alone. After the national outcry prompted by the murders of James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner in Philadelphia, Mississippi, however, the FBI finally opened an office in Jackson. Later that summer, at the 1964 Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, the FBI tapped the phones of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and Martin Luther King Jr. In doing so, the Bureau was complying with a request from President Lyndon Johnson. Because I lived and did research in Mississippi, I've concentrated on acts of the federal government and the civil rights movement in that state. But the FBI's attack on black and interracial organizations was national in scope. For example, after Congress passed the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, a bowling alley in Orangeburg, South Carolina, refused to obey the law. Students from the nearby black college demonstrated against the facility. State troopers fired on the demonstrators, killing 3 and wounding 28, many of them shot in the balls of their feet as they ran away and threw themselves on the ground to avoid the gunfire. The FBI responded not by helping to identify which officers fired in what became known as the Orangeburg Massacre, but by falsifying information about the students to help the troopers with their defense. In California, Chicago, and elsewhere in the North, the Bureau tried to eliminate the breakfast programs of the Black Panther organization, spread false rumors about venereal disease and encounters with prostitutes to break up Panther marriages, helped escalate conflict between other black groups and the Panthers, and help Chicago police raid the apartment of Panther leader Fred Hampton and kill him in his bed in 1969. The FBI warned Black leader Stokely Carmichael's mother of a fictitious Black Panther plot to murder her son, prompting Carmichael to flee the United States. It's even possible that the FBI or the CIA was involved in the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. Raoul, in Montreal, who supplied King's convicted killer James Earl Ray with the alias Eric Galt, was apparently a CIA agent. Certainly Ray, a country boy with no income, could never have traveled to Montreal, arranged a false identity, and flown to London without help. Despite or because of these incongruities, the FBI has never shown any interest in uncovering the conspiracy that killed King. Instead, shortly after King's death in 1968, the FBI twice broke into SNCC offices. Years later, the Bureau tried to prevent King's birthday from becoming a national holiday. The FBI investigated Black faculty members at colleges and universities from Virginia to Montana to California. In 1970, Hoover approved the automatic investigation of all Black student unions and similar organizations organized to project the demands of Black students. The institution at which I taught, Tougaloo College, was a special target. At one point, agents in Jackson even proposed to neutralize the entire college, in part because its students had sponsored out-of-state militant Negro speakers, voter registration drives, and African cultural seminars and lectures, and condemned various publicized injustices to the civil rights of Negroes in Mississippi. Obviously high crimes and misdemeanors. The FBI's conduct and the federal leadership that tolerated it, and sometimes requested it, are part of the legacy of the 1960s. Alongside such positive achievements as the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. As Kenneth O'Reilly put it, when the FBI stood against Black people, so did the government. How do American history textbooks treat this legacy? They simply leave out everything bad the government ever did. They omit not only the FBI's campaign against the civil rights movement, but also its break-ins and undercover investigations of church groups, organizations promoting changes in U.S. policy in Latin America, and the U.S. Supreme Court. Textbooks don't even want to say anything bad about state governments. All 10 narrative textbooks in my sample include part of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, but 9 of them censor out his negative comments about the governments of Alabama and Mississippi. Not only do textbooks fail to blame the federal government for its opposition to the civil rights movement, many actually credit the government, almost single-handedly, for the advances made during the period. In doing so, textbooks follow what we might call the Hollywood approach to civil rights. To date, Hollywood's main feature film on the movement is Alan Parker's Mississippi Burning. In that movie, the 3 civil rights workers get killed in the first 5 minutes. For the rest of its 2 hours, the movie portrays not a single civil rights worker or Black Mississippian over the age of 12 with whom the viewer could possibly identify. Instead, Parker concocts 2 fictional white FBI agents who play out the hoary good cop, bad cop formula and, in the process, double-handedly solve the murders. In reality, that is, in the real story on which the movie is based, supporters of the civil rights movement, including Michael Schwerner's widow, Rita, and every white northern friend the movement could muster, pressured Congress and the executive branch of the federal government to force the FBI to open a Mississippi office and make bringing the murderers to justice a priority. Meanwhile, Hoover tapped Schwerner's father's telephone to see if he might be a communist. Everyone in eastern Mississippi knew for weeks who had committed the murder, and that the Neshoba County deputy sheriff was involved. No innovative police work was required. The FBI finally apprehended the conspirators after bribing one of them with $30,000 to testify against the others. American history textbooks offer a Parker-like analysis of the entire civil rights movement. Like the arrests of the Mississippi Klansmen, advances in civil rights are simply the result of good government. Federal initiative in itself explains such milestones as the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. John F. Kennedy proposed them, Lyndon Baines Johnson passed them through Congress, and thus we have them today. Or, in the immortal passive voice of American history, another civil rights measure, the Voting Rights Act, was passed. Several textbooks even reverse the time order, putting the bills first, the civil rights movement later. Only American Adventures and Discovering American History show the basic dynamics of the civil rights movement. African Americans, often with white allies, challenged an unjust law or practice in a nonviolent way, which then incited whites to respond barbarically to defend civilization, in turn appalling the nation and convincing some people to change the law or practice. Only the same two books celebrate the courage of the civil rights volunteers. And only Discovering American History tells how the movement directly challenged the mores of segregation, with the result that some civil rights workers were killed or beaten by white racists simply for holding hands as an interracial couple or eating together in a restaurant. No book educates students about the dynamics that in a democracy should characterize the interrelationship between the people and their government. Thus, no book tells how citizens can, and in fact have, forced the government to respond to them. Instead, textbooks tell us about the outstanding leadership of John F. Kennedy on civil rights. The challenge of freedom provides a typical treatment. President Kennedy and his administration responded to the call for racial equality. In June 1963, the president asked for congressional action on far-reaching equal rights laws. Following the president's example, thousands of Americans became involved in the equal rights movement as well. In August 1963, more than 200,000 people took part in a march in Washington, D.C. This account reverses leader and led. In reality, Kennedy initially tried to stop the march and sent his vice president to Norway to keep him away from it because he felt Lyndon Johnson was too pro-civil rights. Even Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., a Kennedy partisan, has dryly noted that the best spirit of Kennedy was largely absent from the racial deliberations of his presidency. The damage isn't localized to the unfounded boost textbooks give to Kennedy's reputation, however. When describing the attack on segregation that culminated in the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Triumph of the American Nation makes no mention that African Americans were the plaintiffs and attorneys in Brown v. Board of Education, or that prior cases also brought by the NAACP prepared the way. Today, many black students think that desegregation was something the federal government imposed on the black community. They have no idea it was something the black community forced on the federal government. Meanwhile, young white Americans can reasonably infer that the federal government has been nice enough to blacks, crediting the federal government for actions instigated by African Americans and their white allies surely disempowers African American students today. Surely helps them feel that they have never done anything, as Malcolm X put it. Textbooks treat the environmental movement similarly, telling how Congress passed the laws setting up the Environmental Protection Agency while giving little or no attention to the environmental crusade. Students are again left to infer that the government typically does the right thing on its own. Many teachers don't help. A study of 12 randomly selected teachers of 12th grade American government courses found that about the only way the teachers suggested that individuals could influence local or national governments was through voting. Textbook authors seem to believe that Americans can be loyal to their government only so long as they believe it has never done anything bad. Textbooks therefore present a U.S. government that deserves students' allegiance, not their criticism. "We live in the greatest country in the world," wrote James F. DeLong, an associate of the right-wing textbook critic Mel Gabler, in his critique of American Adventures. "Any book billing itself as a story of this country should certainly get that heritage and pride across." American Adventures, in conveying the basic dynamic of the civil rights movement, implies that the U.S. government was not doing all it should for civil rights. Perhaps as a result, Adventures failed DeLong's patriotism test. "I will not, I cannot endorse it for use in our schools." The textbook's sycophantic presentations of the federal government may help win adoptions, but they don't win students' attention. It's boring to read about all the good things the government did on its own, with no dramatic struggles. Moreover, most adult Americans no longer trust the government as credulously as they did in the 1950s. Between about 1960 and 1974, revelation after revelation of misconduct and deceit in the federal executive branch shattered the trust of the American people, as confirmed in poll after poll. Textbook authors, since they are unwilling to say bad things about the government, come across as the last innocents in America. Their trust is poignant. They present students with a benign government whose statements should be believed. This is hardly the opinion of their parents, who, according to opinion polls, remain deeply skeptical of what leaders in the federal government tell them. To encounter so little material in school about the bad things the government has done, especially when parents and the daily newspaper tell a different story, makes all education suspect, according to Donald Barr. Nor can the textbook author's servile approach to the government teach students to be effective citizens. Just as the story of Columbus the Wise has as its flip side the archetype of the superstitious, unruly crew, so the archetype of a wise and good government implies that the correct role for us citizens is to follow its leadership. Without pushing the point too far, it does seem that many 20th century non-democratic states, from the Third Reich to the Central African Empire, have had citizens who gave their governments too much rather than too little allegiance. The United States, on the other hand, has been blessed with dissenters. Some of these dissenters have had to flee the country. Since 1776, Canada has provided a refuge for Americans who disagree with policies of the U.S. government, from Tories who fled harassment during and after the Revolution, to free blacks who sought haven from the Dred Scott ruling, to young men of draftable age who opposed the Vietnam War. No textbook mentions this Canadian role, because no textbook portrays a U.S. government that might ever merit such principled opposition. Certainly, many political scientists and historians in the United States suggest that governmental actions are a greater threat to democracy than citizen disloyalty. Many worry that the dominance of the executive branch has eroded the checks and balances built into the Constitution. Some analysts also believe that the might of the federal government vis-à-vis state governments has made a mockery of federalism. From the Woodrow Wilson administration until now, the federal executive has grown ever stronger and now looms as by far our nation's largest employer. In the last 30 years, the power of the CIA, the National Security Council, and other covert agencies has grown to become, in some eyes, a fearsome fourth branch of government. Threats to democracy abound when officials in the FBI, the CIA, the State Department, and other institutions of government determine not only our policies, but also what the people and the Congress need to know about them. By downplaying covert and illegal acts by the government, textbook authors narcotize students from thinking about such issues as the increasing dominance of the executive branch. By taking the government's side, textbooks encourage students to conclude that criticism is incompatible with citizenship. And by presenting government actions in a vacuum, rather than as responses to such institutions as multinational corporations and civil rights organizations, textbooks mystify the creative tension between people and their leaders. All this encourages students to throw up their hands in the belief that the government determines everything anyway, so why bother? especially if its actions are usually so benign. Thus, our American history textbooks minimize the potential power of the people, and despite their best patriotic efforts, take a stance that is overtly anti-democratic. Chapter 9. Down the Memory Hole. The Disappearance of the Recent Past. If we do not speak of it, others will surely rewrite the script. Each of the body bags, all of the mass graves will be reopened and their contents abracadabra'd into a noble cause. George Swires, Vietnam veteran. When information which properly belongs to the public is systematically withheld by those in power, the people soon become ignorant of their own affairs, distrustful of those who manage them, and, eventually, incapable of determining their own destinies. Richard M. Nixon. The aim of the historian, then, is to know the elements of the present by understanding what came into the present from the past. For the present is simply the developing past. The goal of the historian is the living present. Frederick Jackson Turner. We see things not as they are, but as we are. Anais Nin. Many African societies divide humans into three categories: those still alive on the earth, the Sasha, and the Zamani. The recently departed, whose time on earth overlapped with people still here, are the Sasha, the living dead. They are not wholly dead, for they still live in the memories of the living, who can call them to mind, create their likeness in art, and bring them to life in anecdote. When the last person to know an ancestor dies, that ancestor leaves the Sasha for the Zamani, the dead. As generalized ancestors, the Zamani are not forgotten but revered. Many, like George Washington or Clara Barton, can be recalled by name, but they are not living dead. There is a difference. Because we lack these key Swahili terms, we rarely think about this distinction systematically, but we also make it. Consider how we read an account of an event we lived through, especially one in which we ourselves took part, whether a sporting event or the Persian Gulf War. We read partly in a spirit of criticism, assessing what the authors got wrong as well as agreeing with and perhaps learning from what they got right. When we study the more distant past, we may also read critically, but now our primary mode is ingestive, especially if we are reading for the first time about an event. We have little ground on which to stand and criticize what we read. Authors of American history textbooks appear all too aware of the Sasha, of the fact that teachers, parents, and textbook adoption board members were alive in the recent past. They seem uncomfortable with it. Revering the Zamani, generalized ancestors, is more their style. By definition, the world of Sasha is controversial because readers bring to it their own knowledge and understanding, which may not agree with what is written. Therefore, the less said about the recent past, the better. I examined how the 10 narrative American histories in my sample cover the 5 decades leading up to the 1980s. I excluded the 1980s because some of the textbooks came out in that decade, so they could not be expected to cover it fully. On average, the textbooks give 47 pages to the 1930s, 43.6 pages to the 1940s, and fewer than 35 pages to each later decade. Even the turbulent decade of the 1960s, including the Civil Rights Movement, most of the Vietnam War, and the murders of Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and John and Robert Kennedy, gets fewer than 35 pages. I used the qualifier narrative in the previous paragraph because the examination revealed a striking difference between the two inquiry textbooks and the narrative textbooks. Discovering American History and The American Adventure, which consist largely of maps, illustrations, and extracts from primary sources, don't downplay the Sasha. Indeed, their attention to the recent past is indicative of their author's intention of making history relevant to current events and issues. Even these two textbooks' early chapters challenge students to apply what they learn to the present. Therefore, despite the fact that both of the books were published before the 1970s ended, they give more space to the 1960s and 1970s than do the 10 narrative textbooks. Unfortunately, these textbooks have long since gone out of favor and print, and, as far as I know, no inquiry textbooks remain on the market. Their lack of continued commercial viability suggests that by slighting the recent past, publishers of narrative textbooks are somehow meeting a need. Probably, it's the need to avoid controversy. Avoiding the Sasha surely does not meet students' needs. Textbook authors may work on the assumption that covering recent events thoroughly is unnecessary because students already know about them. Since textbook authors tend not to be young, however, what is Sasha for them is Zamani to their students. As we college professors get older, we grow ever more astonished at what our undergraduates don't know about the recent past. I first became aware of this phenomenon as the 1970s inexorably became the 1980s. Lecturing on the Vietnam War, I increasingly got blank looks. 1 in 4, then 1 in 2, and in the 1990s, 4 in 5 first-year college students have not known the meaning of the four-letter words hawk and dove. On the first day of class in 1989, I gave my students a quiz, including the open-ended question, "Who fought in the war in Vietnam?" Almost a fourth of my students said the combatants were North and South Korea. I was stunned. To me, this resembled answering 1957 to the question, "When did the War of 1812 begin?" In fact, many recent high school graduates know more about the War of 1812 than about the Vietnam War. It makes little sense and surely does no good to blame the students. It can hardly be their fault. If our civic memories begin when we are about 10 years old, then the last students to have any memory of the Vietnam War graduated from high school in the spring of 1983. The war is unknown territory to today's college undergraduates, who weren't alive when it ended. So are the women's movement, Watergate, and the Carter presidency. Movies, novels, songs, and other elements of popular culture do treat the recent past, but these fuse fact and fiction, as any Rambo fan can attest. Students need information about the recent past from their high school American history courses. The recent past is, after all, the history with the most immediate impact upon their lives today. The notion that history courses should slight the Sasha for the distant tsunami is perverse. Comparing textbook coverage of the Vietnam War and the War of 1812 illuminates this perversion. The War of 1812 took place almost 2 centuries ago and killed maybe 2,000 Americans. Nevertheless, high school history books devote the same quantitative coverage, 9 pages, to the War of 1812 and the Vietnam War. One might argue, I suppose, that the War of 1812 was so much more important than the Vietnam War that it deserves as much space. Our textbooks make no such claim. Most textbook authors don't know what to make of the War of 1812 and don't claim any particular importance for it. Since the War of 1812 lasted only half as long as the Vietnam War, authors can treat it in far more detail. They enjoy the luxury of telling about individual battles and heroes in 1812. Land of Promise, for instance, devotes 3 paragraphs to a naval battle off Put-in Bay Island in Lake Erie, which works out to 1 paragraph per hour of battle. Vietnam gets no such detail. Scant space is only part of the problem. 9 gripping analytic pages on the Vietnam War might prove more than adequate. We might ask what kind of coverage textbooks provide, beginning with the images they supply. Photographs have been part of the record of war in the United States since Matthew Brady's famous Images of the Civil War. In Vietnam, Television images join still photos to shape the perceptions and sensibility of the American people. More than any other war in our history, the Vietnam War was distinguished by a series of images that seared themselves into the public consciousness. I've asked dozens of adults old enough to have lived during the war to tell me what visual images they remember. The list of images they supplied shows remarkable overlap. A short list includes these five specific images. A Buddhist monk sitting at a Saigon intersection, immolating himself to protest the South Vietnamese government. The little girl running naked down Highway 1, fleeing a napalm attack. The national police chief executing a terrified man, suspected of being in the Viet Cong, with a pistol shot to the side of his head. The bodies in the ditch after the My Lai massacre. And Americans evacuating from a Saigon rooftop by helicopter, while desperate Vietnamese tried to climb aboard. The list might also include at least two generic images. B-52s with bombs streaming below them into the pockmarked countryside of Vietnam. And a ruined city such as Hue, nothing but rubble in view, as American and South Vietnamese troops move in to retake it after the Tet Offensive. Merely reading these short descriptions prompts most older Americans to remember the images in sharp detail. The emotions that accompanied them come back vividly as well. Of course, since the main American involvement in the war took place from 1965 to 1973, Americans must have been at least 30 in 1993 to have these images in their Sasha. Today's young people have little chance to see or recall these images unless their history books provide them. They don't. These photographs have gone down the memory hole, that chute to the furnace where embarrassing facts burn to a crisp in George Orwell's 1984. A single book, The American Pageant, includes one of these pictures, the police chief shooting the terrified man. No other textbook reproduces any of them. The American Adventures contains an image of our bombing Vietnam, but the photograph shows B-52s and bombs from below and gives no sense of any damage on the ground. The seven cited images are important examples of the primary materials of the Vietnam War. Hawks might claim that these images exaggerate the aspects of the war they portray. However, the images have additional claims to historical significance. They made history, for they affected the way Americans thought about the war. Several of these photographs remain among the most well-known images in the world even now, 1991, according to Patrick Hagopian. Leaving them out of history textbooks shortchanges today's readers. As a student of mine wrote, "To show a photograph of one naked girl crying after she has been napalmed changes the entire meaning of that war to a high school student." In Vietnam, the U.S. dropped three times as many explosives as it dropped in all theaters of World War II, even including our nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So textbook authors have many images of bomb damage to choose from. On the ground, after the Tet Offensive, in which Viet Cong and North Vietnamese troops captured cities and towns all over South Vietnam, American and South Vietnamese troops shelled Hue, Ben Tre, Quang Tri, and other cities before moving in to retake them. Nonetheless, not one textbook shows any damage done by our side. Of course, the authors and editors of textbooks choose among thousands of images of the Vietnam War. They might make different selections and still do justice to the war, but at the very least, they must show atrocities against the Vietnamese civilian population, for these were a frequent and even inevitable part of this war without front lines, in which our armed forces had only the foggiest notion as to who was ally or opponent. Indeed, attacks on civilians were U.S. policy, as shown by General William C. Westmoreland's characterization of civilian casualties. It does deprive the enemy of the population, doesn't it? We evaluated our progress by body counts and drew free-fire zones in which the entire civilian population was treated as the enemy. Such a strategy inevitably led to war crimes. Thus, My Lai was not a minor event, unworthy of inclusion in a nation's history, but was important precisely because it was emblematic of much of what went wrong with the entire war in Vietnam. My Lai was the most